Excellent, thank you.
Okay, cool. All right, so I'll be talking about pulsars. So the way this basically works, these millisecond pulsars are neutron stars. And if they've been recycled, and this is where the material transfers via accretion during an X-ray binary phase. And we see these things throughout the galaxy, X-ray binaries that are actually transferring this material and spinning these pulsars up. What happens, what we get left over from this accretion process is a millisecond pulsar spinning hundreds of times per second in nearly perfectly circular orbits with a white dwarf. And these things, because they've had the accretion process buries a large chunk of the magnetic field compared to a normal pulsar, they have effectively weak magnetic fields. And so that's about 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 9 Gauss. So they're still incredibly strong from terrestrial laboratory standards, but they're very, very weak for neutron star standards. And those weak magnetic fields, along with the very fast rotation rates, make perfect celestial clocks. And so using these and measuring the pulses from these pulsars, we can do a lot of really, really cool things. And they're incredibly exotic objects, as you know, neutron stars. Strong gravity, very intense magnetic fields, even these weak ones for the millisecond pulsars. Incredible plasma effects. The particles are being accelerated to incredibly relativistic energies, so very, very exotic systems. But we're going to basically treat them as test particles and test clocks in order to do the physics that I'm going to be talking about. So the way this works, I'm going to go into a little bit of detail because this is, since basically I think most of you are theorists, I'm going to explain the way that these observations work. Because the pulsar timing in general is a very, very different way to make measurements than most other things in astrophysics. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time explaining exactly how that works. And one of the reasons why this is tricky is that millisecond pulsars are incredibly faint objects. We cannot see the individual pulses from millisecond pulsars. So even this time series that I have here is wrong. It's dramatically increased in signal-to-noise ratio, just so you can see what the pulses might look like. But we cannot see anywhere close, even with the biggest radio telescopes, the individual pulses. So we have to do some clever integration, and then we do some clever pulse counting, which is known as pulsar timing, in order to get the physics out. And the way the general gist of pulsar timing is this first sentence. We unambiguously account for every single rotation of the neutron star over time scales of years or even decades. And if you do that correctly, you get tremendous precision out of the measurements. So how does that work? So let's say we do have a big radio telescope and we observe a millisecond pulsar. We end up getting a time series of data. This is, like I said, greatly exaggerated in signal to noise. Normally we can't see individual pulses. But because of previous measurements or because of integrating the whole observation together and using a Fourier transform, we know roughly what the instantaneous spin period of the pulsar is. We can integrate up all of the pulsars and get a spin period. Once we know the spin period at a given time, we can divide up our time series and we can split each individual pulse. Even though we can't see every individual pulse, we know where the pulses split. And we can take the data and add those pulses on top of one another. We can fold the data on top of itself, we call that folding, to increase the signal to noise ratio. And one way of visualizing that is something like this in this grayscale. Basically, time is flowing along to the right here. And this is one rotation of the pulsar vertically, so that's also time, or you can think of it as pulse phase. So time is effectively going helically as we're stacking pulses one on top of each other. And when you know the pulse period correctly, if you've divided these pulses in the right spot, the pulses stack right on top of one another, and this dark gray band there are the pulses. Okay? So you can stack hundreds or even thousands of pulses together. And if you've got this pulse period right, they'll stack right on top of one another, and we can take these average slices and measure the time that that average pulse arrives. So it's an average arrival time of a series of pulses. Those are our data points. We call those times of arrival, and those are our measurements. And so at a day at the telescope, we might go and observe for a half hour on a single pulsar, and we might make 5, 10, or 30 measurements of an average arrival time. And so those average arrival times include tens or even hundreds of thousands of pulses all stacked up together like this. So those are the basic measurements. Once you have measurements, especially if you have many measurements during the day, what we can do is we can make a model and start to predict how these pulses will stack in the future. And your eye's already done it. Your eye has extended this line in the future. So you don't have to be observing, continuously on a pulsar to be able to predict every pulse when it's going to arrive. So that, for instance, if you come back the next day, so this is one observation during a day, and this is you go away and go to sleep, you come back with the telescope, and as long as you've been measuring these pulses correctly, you can predict that the next day the first pulse is going to arrive right along this same line. And all this line is, that's phase versus time. And d phi dt, d phase, d time, that's the definition of frequency. That's what frequency is. It's the change in phase with respect to time. Yeah?
So how is this different from just doing, you know, periodic random analysis or a fast Fourier transform?
Right. The difference is phase. So you can get the phases out of a Fourier transform and use the phases, and that would work beautifully if our pulse profiles were sinusoidal. But because they're not, because we tend to have these sharp pulses, they have many harmonics, there is phase information in there as well. You get all that perfectly and coherently if you fold the data rather than use the Fourier transform.
It's more or less like a periodogram.
It is.
And reject.
That's right, except for the fact, this is the crucial aspect, is that we're using the phases to do the counting here. So for instance, by looking at the phase and noticing that the phase is not wrapping, like if this was diagonal here and this was diagonal here, I would know I had a phase wrap. By not seeing that slope, by not seeing that d phi dt, I know I don't have a phase wrap, which means I unambiguously know how many pulses occurred here. So it's a phase measurement rather than a period measurement like a periodogram. And that's where the precision comes from exactly. So, you know, your mind has built a model already that connects these two. That's what we call our timing model. It's basically a prediction and allows us to predict in the future when those pulses are going to arrive. So then I can come back even a few days later and make another observation, and notice here my model does not exactly predict where the pulse phase occurred. There's a small phase deviation. There's a small problem with my model. So now, but it's only a small problem. It's a tiny error. That means I can improve my model. I can make a more precise measurement of the spin frequency, a more precise measurement of the orbits, let's say, or the position on the sky, all these other things we have to account for, and I can make my timing model better. So we bootstrap to a better and better model as we make continuing observations. And it always allows us to predict the next observation, and hopefully the error on that prediction is very small, just like this. And as long as we do that correctly, we never miss count of the number of pulses, and we get tremendous precision out. So what we actually see, if you look at pulsar papers, what we plot in our papers are timing residuals. It's just the measurements minus the model. And so everything is centered around zero. You can see this is residual in terms of microseconds. And a single day at the telescope is like one of these groups of data points. So it'd be like, it'd be a bunch of these measurements here at this day. You can see there's a bunch of measurements with their error bars, and they all center around zero. And if I have a good timing model, you should see no systematics in here. If I were to make a histogram, I'd see a Gaussian distribution purely based on measurement errors. And that's exactly what we see for this pulsar. This is one of the best pulsars. It's known as J1909-37. Over the first 2 years when this thing was discovered, the timing residuals were about 200 nanoseconds RMS. So there's billions of rotations of the pulsar over this time. We know exactly when every one of those pulses arrived to within plus or minus 200 nanoseconds. And if you can do that kind of precision measurement, you get extraordinary things out. So what do these timing solutions look like? So this is a timing model. Here's an example of one for a millisecond pulsar. This is a pretty well-known millisecond pulsar. It's the first two solar mass neutron star. The timing model is basically everything above this line right here. These are the parameters that we had to fit for to unambiguously count for every rotation. And there's position terms on the sky. This thing is just by timing, because the Earth's going around the sun, there's 500 light seconds of light travel time. That means because these things are rotating hundreds of times per second, there's a waves of pulses that are traveling through the solar system. And unless you have the position on the sky perfectly, you'll miscount just because of the motion of the Earth as it goes around the sun. That gives you an incredibly precise position, proper motion, parallax measurement. Here's the spin frequency. There's about 14 significant figures. This parenthesis there is the error in the last digit, by the way. That's what this notation means. Here's the orbital parameters here. The orbital period is known to like 12 significant figures. I mean, these are incredibly precise measurements purely because of that phase measurement and counting unambiguously every pulse. So the whole trick of using pulsars to do basic physics is to figure out the right question we can ask the pulsar that these kind of measurements give us an amazing answer. And to give you kind of a parlor trick type example, I'm going to show you something we can do with eccentricity. So I mentioned that the recycling process when we create millisecond pulsars, because it's a messy process, there's accretion, you get basically tidal circularization of the orbits. And it causes very circular orbits for the white dwarf in the millisecond pulsar. Well, this pulsar is no exception to the very circular orbits. Here is the eccentricity down here, orbital eccentricity, 1.3 times 10 to the minus 6. Okay, so it's 10 to the minus 6, basically. That sounds quite circular, but I'm not used to thinking in terms of eccentricity, so I'm not really sure how circular that is. Well, another way of parameterizing eccentricity is the difference between the semi-major and semi-minor axis of an ellipse. So we can say, what is the difference in the lengths of the semi-major and semi-minor axis? So here's the size of those ellipses. The semi-major axis is 11.3 light seconds, but many significant figures. That's about 3.4 million kilometers, 5 times the solar radius, 9 times the Earth-Moon distance. So that's the size of the orbit that the pulsar is moving in. But the difference between the semi-major and semi-minor axis, because of this eccentricity measurement, is only 2.8 plus or minus 0.2 millimeters. And we can measure, that's a measurement, and we can measure that even though this pulsar is kiloparsecs away. So this is definitely a parlor trick. You know, there's no physics in that particular measurement. But the fact that you can do those kind of measurements and track orbits lets us get tremendous physics out. And of course, the famous example of the groups that first did this was with the original binary pulsar, Hulse and Taylor. It's a double neutron star system. You guys know the story. It won the Nobel Prize. 8-hour highly relativistic orbit, highly eccentric. The pulsar timing, this counting of pulses, will let them measure the precession of the orbit due to general relativity, let them measure two other parameters, two other relativistic parameters, let them measure the pulsar mass, the companion neutron star mass, and of course the famous plot that shows the decay of the orbits due to the emission of gravitational radiation. So this is that right kind of question you can ask pulsars where the measurements give you beautiful results. And of course, this was the first indirect detection of gravitational radiation. Now we have the beautiful LIGO results from last year that have shown a direct detection of gravitational radiation. One of the biggest goals in pulsar astronomy right now is to also make a direct detection of gravitational radiation, just like Chiara talked about yesterday, but using the pulsars as the detectors. So the pulsars are basically the ends of the interferometer arms for our experiment, and we're using a galaxy scale gravitational wave detector. But it's exactly the same type of experiment. Just like in LIGO, you have the test masses at the end of the interferometer arms that are being effectively, the distance between them is being changed because of gravitational radiation. Same exact thing is happening here. Our test masses are the Earth and the various pulsars scattered around the sky. And as very long period gravitational waves pass through our galaxy, space-time is stretched and compressed. And we see a difference in light travel time from the different pulsars that are scattered. So it's the exact same effect. We're measuring time differences in our timing solutions from our pulsars across the sky, just like LIGO uses and measures with its interferometer. There's three different groups around the world who are doing this. Does that have a question? Yeah.
The frequency for LIGO detection is between 100 and 450 hertz.
That's right.
What is the frequency?
Very low frequency. These are nanohertz frequencies. So we're looking, the highest frequency that we can detect is probably about a year frequency, one over a year, I should say. And then the slowest frequency, the lowest frequency that we can detect is basically one over our observation time. So that right now we have about a decade of data roughly. So we're talking one over 10 years would be the frequency. So we have about an order of magnitude range in frequencies that we're currently sensitive with these pulsar timing experiments.
Calculate the story with
X plus.
How does this very low frequency affect that?
Yeah, so I have a strain plot on the next couple pages. I'll talk about that. But that's the general gist. In order to do this, the gravitational wave signals that we expect are of order tens of nanoseconds. That's the time deviations. So we need lots of pulsars that each can be timed at better than, say, 100 nanoseconds, so that we can look for an ensemble signal that's seen by all the pulsars around the sky. And we're now in the regime where we can do that. And there's three big experiments going on around the world. In North America, we're called NanoGrav. And we just got a year and a half ago, the NSF Physics Frontier Center, or they made us a Physics Frontier Center. That's really helped us to help the funding. In Australia, it's called the Parkes Pulsar Timing Array using the Parkes Telescope. And in Europe, it's the European Pulsar Timing Array using a collection of telescopes in Europe. We have the big benefit in North America that we have the two best telescopes for pulsars in the world, and that's because they're big. That's the Arecibo Telescope in Puerto Rico, the one that was shown in the James Bond movie GoldenEye that they filled with water and sunk and blew up and stuff. And then the Green Bank Telescope in West Virginia, which is a 100-meter diameter, fully steerable telescope. And unfortunately, both of those telescopes are under funding, serious funding pressure right now from the National Science Foundation, and the NSF would like to get rid of those telescopes, but they are crucial for our pulsar observations. Anyway, the basic experiment I've already kind of described. So supermassive black holes, that's the signals we're looking for, gravitational waves from supermassive black hole binaries, are pumping gravitational waves through our galaxy. We have pulsars scattered around the sky, and basically what happens is the easiest way to think about it is the Earth is being jiggled by those gravitational waves. The pulsars are as well, but the important part is the Earth, because the Earth is where all of our, it's where we're measuring all of the pulsars. So we have a correlated signal that's caused by the Earth being jiggled. So for instance, if you guys are all pulsars, and I am the Earth with the telescopes, if I get jiggled towards you, all of your signals are a little bit early, the pulsars behind me are a little bit late, and all the pulsars off to the side aren't affected at all. Now that's a dipolar example. Obviously gravitational waves aren't dipolar, they're quadrupolar in nature, so it's slightly more complicated than that, but it's a quadrupolar correlated signal that we expect to see around the sky, caused by the fact that the Earth and the pulsars are jiggling basically according to gravitational waves. So that's basically if the Earth's riding on these very low frequency gravitational waves. We're currently having, last year, each of the pulsar timing arrays made major data releases. Each of these is a day at the telescope for our NanoGrav 9-year data release that came out last year. Every dot is about a half hour of observation time. So as you can see, there's a lot of dots there. There is a huge amount of observing that's happened over the last 9 years over many different pulsars in order to now look for this correlated signal. Here's one of our best pulsars. This shows you the timing residuals that are averaged over the last 9 years. This is actually the same pulsar I showed you in how pulsar timing works in that slide. We've gotten much better now, and with these new instruments, this is our state-of-the-art instrument right now, over the last 7 years, our timing residuals are at about the 40 nanosecond RMS level. So any pulse now, we can tell you when it arrives to within about 40 nanoseconds. So really, really exquisite timing we've improved over the years.
Sorry, Scott, what happened? So is the instrument you change or did?
Yes, this is the instrument. So this was the last generation pulsar instruments that are on the back of the telescopes. So this is basically the improvement of Moore's law. Digital signal processing allowed about an order of magnitude improvement in the amount of radio bandwidth that we sample, as well as the fidelity of that sampling to improve. So you can see the error bars are quite a bit larger here than right here with this new generation of instruments. And this is what we're still using right now, this new generation of instrument. So we already kind of mentioned this a little bit, but where do these gravitational waves come from? So it's supermassive black hole binaries that are throughout the universe. And basically we think that galaxies merge, and the center of every galaxy is a supermassive black hole. And the gist is that because of dynamical friction and other effects, the supermassive black holes will eventually get close together, and we believe eventually merge. And when they're within about one parsec, gravitational waves are their dominant energy loss. And so they're pumping out these year period gravitational waves throughout the universe. That's the signal we're trying to detect. And the timing residuals, that that these things will leave on our pulsars here at Earth are of order 10 nanoseconds. So here, if you have a billion solar mass black hole binary at a gigaparsec with about 10 to the minus 7 hertz, you're pumping out about 10 nanosecond timing residuals. And in terms of strain, that's about 10 to the minus 15 in strain. So it's orders of magnitude larger in terms of strain than what you see from LIGO, but the frequencies are many, many orders of magnitude lower. And our detector is many orders of magnitude bigger to help compensate for those things. So these individual systems are potentially detectable by themselves. And so here's a toy example of that. So back in 2003, there was a Nature paper that basically showed this, what looked like, this is a radio galaxy where there's like corkscrew type jets. And they thought that they measured, using very long baseline interferometry, an orbital period of 1.05 years and a total mass of the black hole binaries of about 50 billion solar masses. So as an observer, whenever, first off, I see a paper in Nature, I'm always skeptical. And second, whenever anyone quotes a periodicity somewhere near a year, there's at least one other thing I know of that has an orbital period of a year. So you want to be a little bit careful. But if this thing were real, and if it were at a Z of only 0.02, it would be producing huge amplitude gravitational waves here on Earth. And as a matter of fact, at the time, the current pulsar timing data should have seen this signal in it. And our error bars on all these data points are smaller than the size of the symbol in this case. Obviously, we did not see those gravitational waves, and we basically either disproved this system or general relativity, you know, at the time. Obviously, now with the LIGO detection, the GR thing is not the answer, and so we basically ruled out this system. But if it were that close and of that mass, that's the type of system we could directly see individually.
But what was the mass ratio expected in that case?
I don't know if they had predicted what the mass ratio was. I think that was the total system mass.
The mass ratio was huge. You couldn't have seen
that. That's true. Yeah. That was assuming equal masses. That's exactly right.
No, but you would have to assume, because what they saw the tangent period, so or tangent something, so if one of masses was small, you wouldn't have seen it.
Yeah, and in 100 to
right.
1, you would have still seen
It probably depends on where the radio waves are coming from. Are they coming from the small black hole? Are the jets being generated by the big black hole or the small black hole? And you know what's causing that modulation? And the answer is not what they thought. but people have continued to find very close by massive binary systems. Here's an example from just 2 years ago, also in Nature, so we've got to watch out. But this has a 5-year orbital period. It's about, and if it were 10 times closer with the parameters that they suggest, it would be detectable in our data. We really don't think this is our likely first source that we're going to detect with pulsar timing arrays. Most likely, it's the ensemble of all of these binaries that are out there. They're going to cause a stochastic background of low-frequency gravitational waves. And so, in general, when you add up all of the supermassive black hole binaries throughout the universe, you get a power law. It's easy to calculate. It's been done. Kiara probably mentioned it in her talk yesterday. But that stochastic black hole binary background is probably the signal that we're going to see. And what it does is it causes correlated timing residuals. I already mentioned that. And that's due to the fact that gravitational waves are quadrupolar in nature, and it's a very specific correlation on the sky. So this is a kind of a famous plot in the pulsar timing world. It's called the Hellings and Downs curve, and it shows that correlation. And this is a two-point correlation function. So if you take the timing residuals from one pulsar, you find its separation on the sky, and find the timing residuals from that other pulsar, and you correlate them, you'll get a point on this diagram. And if you have enough pairs of pulsars, you can populate this diagram. And this curve shows you what a quadrupolar correlation would look like. So this is a very distinct signature of gravitational radiation. And if we had other errors, like in our atomic clocks or in the solar system ephemeris, you wouldn't get this type of signal. So it's a nice way of showing that we have gravitational waves and not some other low frequency noise in our data. Yeah.
LIGO, you calculate what's called the waveform.
Yep.
There's a quiescent monitor phase.
Exactly.
So can we do that for this? I have to solve Einstein's equation for a finite supermassive black.
That's right. So if, for instance, one of those potential sources that I mentioned was close by enough, and we knew we could see it on the sky, knew its period, we could calculate the waveform. And in general, because we're not near merger, we're not actually looking at mergers, we're looking at the tens of thousands of years before they merge, we're actually in a very easy to calculate part of the regime. We basically get, if it's equal mass, we get sinusoidal gravitational waves signal, basically. That's exactly right.
It's a big problem.
Yep. But we are not in that regime. So it's very easy using just post-Keplerian approximations. You can actually calculate the waveform. As long as you know the inclination and the masses and stuff like that, you can easily calculate that. But in general, what we think we're going to see is the ensemble of thousands of those together, and that causes this power law distribution. The nice thing is that even with that background where we don't know the individual waveform of every source, you still see this correlated Hellings and Downs curve in the data. And so that's the distinctive signal that we would be looking for. So if we make a first detection in pulsar timing array, you're not going to see a beautiful waveform, probably. You're going to see data points like this that are scattered around this Hellings and Downs curve, showing that we've seen that quadrupolar correlation. Yeah?
So it seems to me that, you know, over time, your mass function is going to evolve. So
mm-hmm.
at earlier
yep.
times, you're going to see more equal mass mergers. Then as you go to late time, it's going to diverge because big black holes become
yep.
rarer. So how does that affect, what do you have to assume, and how does that affect the curve there?
So it definitely does.
And how do you do that?
Yeah, it definitely does make, it definitely does affect the prediction. The nice thing is that this curve right here is purely due to the quadrupolar nature of gravitational waves. It only depends on how gravitational waves propagate. So this signal doesn't matter. The amplitude of the signal and its frequency and spectrum depend on exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. Yeah. Is there another question back there? Okay, so let's go on here. So like I said, last year there was each of the pulsar timing arrays gave off papers with their upper limits. I'm not going to go into detail. These are our noise curves. This is from the Parks group. This is due to the fitting of positions. This is at 1 year. But as you go to longer frequencies, so this is frequency along this axis, as you go to lower frequencies, our sensitivity improves until it turns over at 1 over t. That's the length of our observation set. That's where this turnover happens. Here's the nanograv curves. Looks very, very similar. And here's the predictions, and this is all in terms of strain, of where the supermassive black hole binaries will live, the ensemble of them throughout the universe. And as you can see, if you take some of these models, these colored bands are all the models. Some of the models were now dipping into their predictions. These pulsar timing array measurements are becoming astrophysically interesting and relevant, and we're starting to put limits on some of the assumptions that go into calculating what the background levels actually are. If you take just based on these, those measurements, as well as the most recent cosmological big scale simulations like Illustris, there's a paper that just came out a few months ago where they used Illustris to make predictions. This black line right here is the prediction. Once again, you can see it's a power law, just like I was mentioning when you put all these black holes together. Here are the limits of the PTAs. They're just above this line. So this is probably the current best guess as to the levels of where the background signal is. So we think they're just below our sensitivity right now. And the good thing is that our sensitivity is rapidly improving. So here it shows how that sensitivity improves. So the red line shows how 95%. Yep,
so
sure.
Why is PPTA better than others?
So the PPTA, I would say last year was better. And the reason why is that they got a slightly earlier start. That they started about 2 years earlier, and they had one or two of the very, very best millisecond pulsars that were only visible in the far south. Those pulsars, that one particular pulsar, I should say, over long time spans, once you get beyond about a decade, we're starting to see intrinsic noise in that pulsar. So it's not contributing as much weight to the analysis anymore. And now the big telescopes, even though we started a little bit later in nanograv, our rate of improvement is faster than theirs, so we are passing them basically right now, I would say. And I think if you ask them, they would challenge my assertion a little bit. but I think if you ask the, let's say, the Europeans to judge between the Australians and us, I think they would agree. But we'll see. Anyways, so if you look at how this is how our sensitivity improves with time, this is the 95% upper limit, and this is strain just as a function of time. You can see how steep this curve is. It's really improving rapidly. These were the well-measured, or I should say, these were the early theories when we proposed for several big grants. This is where the best guesses of the background sat. This current paper that I just mentioned from Illustris says that no matter what, it should be above about right here. It should be above 3 times 10 to the minus 16. And you can see these curves, this is a 95% upper limit, this is a 50% chance to detect, and this is a 95% chance to detect. They're all improving very, very rapidly. And so that we should start seeing evidence for gravitational waves in our data basically now. Because this is when we are able to make a 3 sigma statement of detection. So we're at a very interesting time in these pulsar timing array data sets. And if we can get these groups to work together, which we're trying very hard with the International Pulsar Timing Array, where we combine all of our data, we instantaneously gain about a factor of 2 in sensitivity. The problem is, each of these groups is very competitive. We all have our own egos. It's hard to get us to sit together and put all of our data together, but we're trying and we're working. So I'm the chair of actually a data combination group that's combining all of last year's data together, which should give us the best gravitational wave limits right now. And then what we want to do is add in the most recent data, because you saw how fast these curves improve. We actually could be there with the international data set now, which I think is interesting. But it takes a lot of effort to combine these data sets.
So the factor of 2 is coming because you have 4 times more pulsars?
No, so we have a probably, if you look at every individual pulsar timing array, and you add all the other ones together, we probably have a factor of 2 more pulsars, because there's a lot of overlap already. There's only a certain number of really good pulsars on the sky, and each group wants to time those. But you have a lot more observations, so you get kind of a square root of n effect from that. And because you're adding more pulsars, that also improves, because every pair of pulsars gives you more data points on that Hellings and Downs curve. Those are the two main effects, those two things together. It also helps somewhat with some systematics, because there's different observing frequencies that lets us remove the interstellar medium and some other effects, but that's a higher order correction.
That curve as a function of time is supposed to go as 1 over square root of t?
No, it actually improves faster than that for various reasons. And one of the biggest reasons is that we're adding pulsars, and this is going to be part of my later part of my talk. By adding pulsars to the array, good pulsars, as long as you wait just basically 2 years, and you can time those pulsars for 2 years, because of this correlation that we're looking for, new pulsars let you improve really rapidly. Our sensitivity is directly proportional to the number of pulsars. So that makes this faster than square root of t. Yes?
Where does that lower limit on gravitational wave come
from? This is basically the fact that we know galaxies are emerging, and there's no way, I guess we don't know for a fact that the black holes are emerging, but this is assuming that if they merge, they can't see any way to get a lower limit than 3 times 10 to the minus 16 if black holes merge. Even if environmental effects are causing the gravitational waves to go to higher frequencies because of mass ratios or eccentric orbits or all these other things.
But it's still assuming some solution to the final question.
That's right. Yeah, that is correct. But I mean, I think most people believe that the final parsec problem is a theoretical problem and not a problem of nature. Yeah, was there another question?
The LIGO, the black holes are spiraling with like a 10 to the 98. But here you have 2 galaxies colliding.
Yep.
So what about the physics of the collision?
Yeah, so the physics of the collision is exactly where the black holes get close, because you have all the n-body effects, as well as gas dynamics effects, that's causing the galaxies to mix together. That causes dynamical friction, so you get a lot of scattering of stars, and that allows the supermassive black hole binaries to get within a parsec. But once they're within a parsec, most theorists don't think, that there's enough stars and gas available to cause the black holes to get closer. because once you really need to get the black holes within substantially subparsec regimes so that it's dominated by gravitational wave emission. However, observationally, we see basically zero evidence that most galaxies have black hole binaries. So we believe that they must merge. The question is, how exactly are they fixing this final parsec problem, as it's known?
I'm much worried about shock of these things collide. Physics is very complicated.
Yeah, that's right. Although, luckily, the black holes don't care at all about any of those large-scale effects, except for that the gas in the stars do help them get closer. But how
well constrained is the time scale for the black holes to actually get to the final parsec? I mean, there's a lot has to happen.
Yep.
And if that, you could easily imagine an order of magnitude, it could take 10 to the 10 years typically, or 10 to the 9 years. I've heard quotes of various ranges, but that has to affect
it absolutely
quite
does
substantially the predictions.
But this also, I would say there's two answers to that. First off is that simulations, people who've simulated galactic mergers with simple gas dynamics as well as n-body stellar dynamics, they've shown that these dynamical friction effects are quite effective, and the black holes actually get to the centers quite rapidly. So in something that's much less than the dynamical time of the galaxies merging. So that's a relatively rapid process to get the black holes to the center. But I think that's also borne out by the observations. If we look at normal, at regular galaxies that we know have had mergers happen, we do not see two nuclei. It's very, very rare, except for in early stages of mergers, to see multiple nuclei. So the nuclei merge relatively rapidly, and that's where the black holes are. So we think that nature solves those problems quite easily.
You don't know the rate.
We know the ensemble rate of galaxy mergers from cosmological simulations and roughly from observations, but we don't know the detailed rate. I would say that's correct. Yeah. And we certainly don't know the overall amplitude, because the rate as well as the black hole mass function defines what the overall amplitude of that stochastic background is. And so that's the big uncertainty. That's why this gray band is a factor of 5 or 10. As a matter of fact, it's an order of magnitude in uncertainty right now of what the actual amplitude is. The nice thing is that we're already substantially eating into this band. We're about halfway through this band now. And like I said, the most recent things, which are these most recent estimates, suggest we're probably down here is where the signal actually is. So we're approaching those soon as well.
So quick question. Yeah. So are you at the mercy of how the new pulsars you find have smaller intrinsic noises?
Yep.
How do you know?
Absolutely. We have to time them. And the good thing is, this is one of the reasons why I'm very optimistic about these experiments. 10 years ago, no one had timed millisecond pulsars for extended amounts of time to very, very high precision. Each group would do one and two type experiments at the roughly microsecond level of precision, but not the 100 nanosecond level of precision, or even the tens of nanosecond level of precision. So no one knew whether the intrinsic noise of pulsars was going to be low enough. I think what we found observationally is that almost all millisecond pulsars, not all, but the majority, behave beautifully. And so that at least to the levels of precision that we need, which is 100 nanoseconds over a decade, let's say, most millisecond pulsars behave nicely. And that's been a great thing, because people did not even know if we'd be able to get to these limits, let alone be able to predict that we could go beyond it. But the pulsars are behaving. I think that's a big message to let people know, including the new ones that we're finding. And I'll show you some plots of new ones that we're finding as well. All right. Where are we right now? So NanoGrav is preparing an 11-year data release right now. We've run our noise models. We've done gravitational wave detection experiments on our data right now. These papers should be coming out within the next few months. There's interesting stuff in our data. So highly preliminary. The one interesting thing is I showed you how fast on that last plot, how fast we predict to improve our limits. Well, our 11-year limits are about the same as our 9-year limits. That could mean one of two things. There's something wrong with our whole data and our processing, but we don't believe that's the case. Like I said, we think the pulsars are behaving beautifully. Things look correct. Or we're starting to see hints of something in our data, some red noise process in our data. Both of those things would cause the new limits to be the same as the old limits. If this is something interesting, like gravitational waves, we should see the significance of that rise over the next coming years. But this plot shows, these two that I've circled here are the most important ones. We're using the best planetary ephemerides, so the Jet Propulsion Laboratory for the interplanetary space missions has the best knowledge of our solar system dynamics. Using the very best JPL knowledge of our solar system, these are our basically posteriors of where the gravitational wave background should be in terms of strain, log strain. This blue curve right here with this low tail, that low tail that's non-zero, showed why we had an upper limit before. But when we add two more years of data, it becomes this gray curve right here, and you can see the posterior is much more strongly peaked around a number, which is what we'd expect to see if we started to see a detection. But the upper limit is about the same. If you want a 95% upper limit, you're going to get the same rough number. There's still a little tail here from the 11-year data set, but the fact that we're having this increase in something that might indicate correlated red noise is really interesting. I will mention that this does change depending on the ephemeris that we use. And so this is astonishing to me. Our pulsars are giving us as much information about planetary masses and velocities as the JPL probes to those missions. That's how precise these pulsar timing measurements are now, that we are needing more precise measurements than JPL can give us right now. And so we're actually talking with the JPL ephemeris people to improve their data for us, because it's so important for our work. But I think this is highly indicative that the pulsars are behaving and the experiment is going incredibly well, and we may be starting to see things in our data, which also makes sense from the modeling side as well. We're now expected to start seeing gravitational waves. So it's very interesting.
Would it be possible for you to fit for the ephemerides and the...
Absolutely. The problem is, this is the exact problem. If we have to fit for at least the major planets and their masses and velocities, we add many more parameters. And the problem is, all of those are low frequency parameters, because it's the orbits of mostly Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, very low frequencies. You know, their orbital periods are all many years. Those low frequencies look like red noise in our data. It's those low frequencies that we are trying to fit for gravitational waves. So what we really want is JPL to give us really, really precise data for the orbits, so we don't have to fit for those and suck out gravitational wave signal.
Aren't those all dipole?
They're all dipole, that's right.
And like you said, you could get this demo.
That's right. And so right now, this extra bump in the posterior. Right now, if we do a Bayesian model selection test and look at the Bayes factors for do we see this quadrupolar correlation versus dipolar, it's only a slight hint of preference for the quadrupolar correlation right now. But it's a very, very small signal right now, too. But the nice thing is, with next year, given how fast things improve, that should dramatically change.
That's really the answer, to be confident, is that you have to fit for dipole and fit for quadrupole or the Hilling.
That's right.
Thing,
yep.
And then that's clean separation. Right?
That's exactly, I completely agree. That's exactly right. And that's the beautiful thing about this measurement, is that Hellings and Downs curve is a really distinctive signature of gravitational waves. Yeah. All right, I'm going to move beyond this. I'm going to show you one or two other bits of physics. I only have a few minutes left, so I'm going to skip ahead. There's a bunch of ways we can improve. I've already kind of hinted. We can build, I'm going to skip that. Some new instrumentation would help us a little bit, but that's not the dominant effect anymore. One of the best ways of improving our sensitivity is more pulsars. And every big radio telescope is searching for new pulsars right now. It's a huge computational problem. We're taking petabytes of data. We're using thousands and thousands and thousands of cores all the time on supercomputers to process the data. And the reason for that is what I mentioned, that we're directly proportional to the number of pulsars, our minimum strain sensitivity. So it really helps to add new pulsars to our pulsar timing arrays. And we've been very successful. If you look at the last few years, here's the number of millisecond pulsars. We've quadrupled the number in the last 12 years and doubled the number in the last 6. And many of these are now part of these pulsar timing array experiments, and we're continuing to add new ones every year, which really helps. The Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope has helped tremendously, much to people's surprise. It turns out that basically every millisecond pulsar emits gamma rays. We did not know that before Fermi flew. So what Fermi's doing now is it's finding, as it's continuing to integrate and build up a sky map, it's finding gamma ray point sources in the sky. Some of them have spectral indices that and gamma ray spectra that don't look like AGN. They look like neutron stars. So they say, hey, take a look at this source with your radio telescope. So they give us kind of an X marks the spot on the sky. We point a sensitive radio telescope at it, and we find a new millisecond pulsar. And we've so far found about 80 of these. Just this last week, we found three more. This was one from 2 weeks ago. This is a 1.78 millisecond pulsar, one of the fastest rotating millisecond pulsars known. This dark band right here shows you how bright the signal is. This is time versus pulse phase. When you integrate it up, this is the pulse profile. It has a very narrow pulse. It's very bright. This is exactly the type of pulsar we're looking for. This is going to be an excellent timer for adding to NanoGrav or and the other pulsar timing arrays. And two of the others that we found this past week are also beautiful. So these bright pulsars are still out there. They've been missed in previous surveys for a wide variety of reasons. So this is a really great way of going after these new things.
So far, every Fermi suspect candidate for a pulsar, has it been confirmed? So every time you look for what Fermi tells you,
so
you find
the ones that have enough statistics that you can really say this looks like a pulsar, all of those have been shown to be millisecond pulsars. The problem is that because Fermi, the longer it integrates, some of these sources it's finding are only like 4 gamma rays over 8 years, and it's hard to fit a spectrum to 4 or 12 gamma rays, right? So they, what you get is, this kind of looks like it might be a pulsar, and that's where we are right now. We're looking at those sources, so our success rate now is at about the 10% level. So at about 10% of the Fermi sources now turn out to be millisecond pulsars, but that's still way better than surveying the whole sky. So the last 5 minutes, I just want to talk about one of these new systems that we found a few years ago that's turning out to be very interesting for other physics as well.
That's paper in Nature.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you don't want to believe this one either. This is probably wrong. That's right. good point. This pulsar was found in a survey with the Green Bank Telescope. It's a very bright pulsar. It has very narrow pulses. This is a nanograv level pulsar. We can time it to about 100 nanosecond timing precision. It's exactly the type of pulsar we're looking for. We have not yet added this to nanograv because this one has a wrinkle. Unlike most other millisecond pulsars that are in binaries, this is in a hierarchical triple system. But it's got two white dwarf companions, and that makes it very, very interesting. It's highly hierarchical. This is a two-scale diagram of what the orbits look like. So here's the outer orbit. There's a white dwarf. It's about 0.4 solar masses out here, and it orbits every 327 days. This inner binary is orbiting on this cyan circle. So it's kind of like going like this around the center of mass here. And that inner binary is the pulsar, which is orbiting here. And this 0.15 solar mass, or 0.2 solar mass white dwarf out here. This orbit happens every 1.6 days. This orbit happens every 327 days. So highly hierarchical, a neutron star with two white dwarfs with a perfect clock in it. There's nothing to perturb the system. There's no gas. There's no other planets, anything. This is Newton's perfect three-body system that he talked about in the Principia. And using just three-body effects plus special relativity, because the pulsar is moving at tens of kilometers a second, we have to take into account time dilation. But it's taking into account time dilation plus three-body effects completely solves the whole orbit to exquisite precision. We know all the geometry, we know all the masses, we know everything. Here's an example of that. These are pulsar timing residuals where I've left the orbits in. So I haven't removed the orbits. And you can see here's the 327-day outer orbit. If I zoom in on this little chunk, here's the inner orbit. There's tens of thousands of data points in here. Each of these colored bands includes hundreds and hundreds of measurements of arrival times. The error bars are a million times too small to see on this plot. So these orbits are measured beautifully. And the three-body effects, you can see the precision. So these are the error bars on the last two digits. We have 4 and 5 significant figures on all the masses. We know all the inclinations, everything. So the system is known. The physics comes out of this, not just with these measurements, because that's just Newtonian physics, basically, which is cool. But the cool physics is that we are going to be able to provide a really unique test of general relativity, and that's of the strong equivalence principle with these. And since most people don't usually talk about the strong equivalence principle, I'll explain about that, what that is. So the weak equivalence principle is, as you all know, the universality of free fall, basically inertial mass equals gravitational mass, all those things. So here's a feather and a bowling ball. If it falls in a vacuum, they'd fall at the same rate. Okay. This just shows that happening in acute segment from this Brian Cox show, where they evacuated this huge vacuum chamber in Cleveland to do this, to make this clip. It's cute, you can see it online. But what the strong equivalence principle does is it basically says that all the weak equivalence principle applies, as well as Lorentz invariance and other stuff like that. But it says that it applies to an object's self-gravity as well, so that basically gravitational binding energy gravitates as well. And this is interesting because GR is the only workable theory of gravity. I know I'm talking to some experts in this room who can probably tell me if I'm wrong, but Cliff Will says that this is right. It's the only workable theory of gravity where the strong equivalence principle holds unequivocally. So that's interesting. So what it means is that if we can find the right system to test the strong equivalence principle, we should try to do that because it's a very different kind of test of GR. And in this case, we have a neutron star that has very strong gravitational binding energy because GM over RC squared is about 0.1 for a neutron star. The white dwarfs have weak gravitational binding energy, and there's two of them. So we have an object with strong gravitational binding energy and an object with weak gravitational binding energy. That's that inner binary. And they're both falling in the outer gravitational potential of that outer white dwarf. So it's providing the potential well to do the experiment. And we have two objects with very different binding energy that are both falling in that outer potential. So it's exactly like the hammer and the feather experiment, but with a neutron star and a white dwarf. And the way that you parameterize this test is by the so-called Nordvet parameter, which is based on this delta, which is based on the Nordvet parameter times this epsilon, which is related to the gravitational binding energy. And since we have a strongly gravitating object, that's what makes this system very interesting. And I should mention that the best measurements so far are from lunar laser ranging. The problem with solar system tests are is this epsilon here is basically zero. It's 10 to the minus 12 or so for each of the objects in our solar system. So you can't really compare strong versus weak gravity in our solar system very well. But in this system, you can. So in the last minute or two, here's the signal we're looking for. When you actually calculate what an SEP violation would look like in our data, this is as a function of the inner orbit, so that's the 1.6 day orbit, and the outer orbit, we would see systematic residuals that look like these diagonal lines. Basically, what's happening is it's polarizing that orbit. It causes an ellipticity in the orbit that's due to the fact that gravity is pulling on those two objects differently. And that causes this very strong systematic in our data. And if this is this is what would happen if there's a deviation four times smaller than what's even seen than the best limits by lunar laser ranging. And you can see these colors correspond to minus and plus 5 microseconds. I told you this is 100 nanosecond pulsar, and these are integrated effects. We can do way better than this. And even with our original discovery data, already people were saying that we're already factors of 20 or 50 better than lunar laser ranging. So where are we now? So once again, highly preliminary. We haven't put a paper out yet. We were hoping to have a paper out more than a year ago. The reason we haven't is that we're seeing weirdness in our data. We're seeing a delta that's about 5 sigma from zero. So what we're seeing right now looks like a deviation from GR. But what it probably is some weird systematic in our data. So we're trying all sorts of different processing. We have this beautiful post-Keplerian PPN parameterized post-Newtonian Lagrangian by Ken Nordvet that Ann Archibald, who is fantastic, has implemented and is doing all of the orbital integrations. We've done all sorts of tests. Everything that we're doing for nanograv to remove systematics from our data, we're working on, we're recalibrating. The tricky thing is that our best telescope, Arecibo, gives us a strong deviation, and the other two telescopes give us deviations which are within 2 sigma, show that within 2 sigma they agree with Arecibo, but they also agree with GR. The only one that doesn't agree with GR is Arecibo by itself. So we want to try to understand this, we want to try to hopefully get rid of it before we make a publication. But this is where we are right now. Even if we get rid of this, you can see the size of the errors. We're at the 10 to the minus 6 level. This is, like I said, about a factor of 50 or so better than lunar laser ranging. So even if we show that GR is consistent with our data right now, we're going to still have by far the best limits on the SEP that anyone's ever had. And the one thing that I want to stress is that this was completely unexpected. The reason why we get to do this cool test is because we were looking for new pulsars for NanoGrav, and we happen to find a pulsar where you can do cool basic physics. And this has happened throughout the history of pulsar astronomy. Interesting systems have been found that let you do really cool basic physics, and I think we can continue to do that. This just shows how the triple system is going to constrain scalar tensor theories, and it's way better than lunar laser ranging, better than Gaia and Cassini by orders of magnitude. This is a really beautiful system to do interesting tests. I'll just wrap up to say the future is really bright. There's a big telescope called FAST that was just completed in China, 500 meters in diameter. This looks like Arecibo, but it's in China. This centerpiece right there is this. These are people standing around that ring right there. Those are people. That is really big. And we need big telescopes to be able to detect these pulsars. And Canada is part of the Square Kilometer Array, at least right now. This is going to be the fantastic pulsar machine in the future. It should find thousands and thousands of new pulsars. We only know of a few percent of the pulsars in our galaxy. It should find a ton of them. Very interesting in the future. So I think the summary, I think the future is really bright. These new telescopes and the new searches are going to find lots of great new pulsars, and we're going to continue to do a lot of excellent basic physics. And I'm quite optimistic about a direct detection of gravitational waves within the next few years, let's say 3 to 5 years, with pulsar timing arrays. And I'll end right there. Thanks.
Sir.
So the hierarchical triple just looks marvelous. I had a bunch of questions about it. First, is it all coplanar?
Yes. Within 0.15 degrees or something.
So does that mean that you think it was like a binary capture scenario or something?
No, there's about two or three papers that have come out about the stellar and binary evolution of the system, and most of them agree that this all happened just due to normal evolutionary physics. So what happened almost certainly is that the three massive stars that became the neutron star and the two white dwarfs, each of them, when they went through a giant phase, they would have had to cause basically common envelope scenarios probably three times. So this whole system was probably buried in the envelopes of the massive stars at least three times. And all that is very dissipative and lossy and stuff. And so during those phases, it probably caused everything to become highly coplanar as well as highly circular. That's the rough hand wavy explanation for all of that. But I think everyone was surprised to see how coplanar everything is.
And then a question about the tests. I mean, the exquisite sensitivity or precision of pulsar tests are just incredible, but it also means that you end up seeing a lot of dirt. So
yep.
how worried are you about non-gravitational forces impacting your analysis here? Why tidal effects?
Of the triple system?
Yeah.
Well, given that we see deviation, we're really worried. I mean, we're looking into all those things, right? So it's slightly worrisome to us that we're seeing the dominant effect on Arecibo. And each telescope is a little bit different. You have to treat each telescope with kind of care. And this is a highly precise pulsar. Like I said, it's a excellent nanograv level pulsar. So we have to be really careful that we're doing their data calibration absolutely perfectly, that we're taking care of polarization effects, the interstellar medium. You know, the same type of stuff you guys have to worry about for the Event Horizon Telescope, we're worrying with exquisite detail for this pulsar timing as well. So we want to make sure we have all of those things figured out first. The initial calculations on, like what you said, on tidal distortion and stuff, they are orders of magnitude below what we expect to see. Even on the white dwarfs, I mean, the white dwarfs would have to be spinning near breakup and be incredibly oblate and stuff to cause any kind of classical effects that we would see. That's the beauty of the system. I mean, it really is basically three-point masses. If that outer star was a red dwarf rather than a white dwarf, we wouldn't be able to do nearly as well.
But you have four measurements, I think, so could you have seen a deviation of the size of Arecibo using the other telescope?
Yeah. Let's look at I'll show you the error bars again. The error bars, the GBT's error bars are pretty good. but they're not as good as Arecibo's.
Right.
So this is Western work. It's a significantly smaller telescope in Europe, and you can see its error is the same size. There's basically, you know, less than one significant figure here.
Right.
So that's consistent with zero, but it's also consistent with Arecibo. This is it's a six sigma deviation or so. The GBT, you know, the errors are significantly smaller, but they're still of the same order of the size of the measurement. The signs are the same. That's it's either encouraging or discouraging depending on what you would like to see from this experiment. But the error bars are quite different in size, and that's the big issue. So this is really what we're working on right now, trying to figure out what's going on. And this has been the main cause of our delay of getting an SEP test paper out, but we're working on it.
Historically, Newton was not able to solve the three-body problem.
Right.
Because the Royal Astronomer didn't give data. So now we have this remarkably accurate data.
Mm-hmm.
What's the status of Newtonian gravity?
Newtonian gravity is beautiful. So if you add, especially like I said, I have a beautiful plot that I could show you if you wanted to see it later. If you just use Newtonian gravity, the pulsar timing residuals have these incredible systematics at the 10 to 20 microsecond level, and that's purely spectral relativity. As soon as you turn on time dilation and the overall system gravitational redshift, the gravitational redshift of the pulses leaving the whole system, it instantly flattens perfectly. So Newtonian gravity plus special relativity solve this system down to the at least hundreds of nanosecond level. It's not a highly relativistic system, so GR is not super important, although general relativistic precession of periastron is important, but the orbits are so circular that it's not, you can't really easily see it here. Newtonian gravity plus special relativity works beautifully with this system.
That's remarkable.
Yeah, it's really, really stunning. And when we put this paper out, we're going to release all of our data too, so people can play with it. I mean, it's lovely to be able to do these little tests and to play with it. So, do you have a question?
I think the pilot trick is wrong.
I would love to prove me wrong on that, but I checked that about 50 times.
But I mean, you said that the difference between the periastron and what is that?
It's not a periastron. Sure. It's the difference between the semi-major and semi-minor axis.
Semi-major and semi-minor. So that's basically, I mean, two times eccentricity. The relative difference is two times eccentricity, times semi-major axis. So if your eccentricity is 10 to the minus 6, so that's 10 to the minus 6 times.
No, it goes as a square. This is the thing. This is why it's a Potter trick. The difference between the semi-major and semi-minor axis goes as the square of that. That's why it's a Potter trick.
It's not periastron. Okay. I see. That's
exactly why it's a Potter trick.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Any other questions? I mean, we're beyond the hour, so.
All right. That's all.
Thanks.